From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Winston Churchill is one of the towering figures of the 20th century. And while many people are familiar with Churchill's World War II experiences and leadership, few of us know about the young Churchill's remarkable adventure in South Africa during the Second Boer War, his capture, his imprisonment, and remarkable escape. That's the story that best-selling author Candace Millard covers in her new book, Hero of the Empire. Coming up, Radio Times producer Debbie Bilder talks with Millard about the amazing adventures of the young Winston Churchill. Then what does it take to run a $49 billion government agency? Ira Goldstein from the Reinvestment Fund tells us what Ben Carson will face if confirmed as Secretary of HUD. Stay with WHYY in Philadelphia for more after the news from NPR. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome back to Radio Times. Winston Churchill was just 24 years old when he arrived in South Africa in 1899. He was a war correspondent covering the Second Boer War, full of confidence and eager to make his mark on the world. According to best-selling author Candace Millard, that's exactly what he did. Millard's written a new book about this period in Churchill's life called Hero of the Empire, The Boer War, A Daring Escape, and The Making of Winston Churchill. Producer Debbie Bilder is a fan of Millard's other histories, The River of Doubt, about Teddy Roosevelt's harrowing trip on the Amazon, and Destiny of the Republic, that centered around the assassination of James Garfield. She sat down with Millard recently to talk with her about the young Winston Churchill.
Winston Churchill is one of those celebrated figures of the 20th century. I think there's been something like 12,000 books written about him. Why did you choose to write a book on him, and in particular, this sort of less well-known period of his life?
I heard the story about his capture and imprisonment and escape from the Boers in South Africa about 25 years ago. And it just stayed with me because I was so surprised, first of all, that I didn't know it. You know, I mean, it's an incredible story in itself, but that it happened to Winston Churchill, and it really launched his political career. It absolutely made him a hero, and it propelled him to the world stage. And so after I turned in the manuscript for my second book, I just started thinking about it again, and I started doing some more research and realized how important the Boer War was as well, and how important this was to Churchill's life, and I was just hooked.
Well, when we meet Winston Churchill in your book, he's pretty young. He's in his early 20s, but he's already fought in something like four wars, right, on three different continents. Uh-huh. Was this typical of somebody, especially this young aristocrat?
No, this is Winston Churchill. He was incredibly ambitious from a very young age. So you're right. So the Boer War is his fourth war on three different continents. He's 24 years old. He's also written three books, including, most people don't know this, his first and only novel, Savrola. He's already run for parliament and lost. And so he's just throwing himself at life. He believes that he is destined for greatness. He tells his mom that he has faith in his star. But, you know, unlike a lot of young people who think that they're destined to do great things in life, he doesn't sit around waiting for it to happen. He makes it happen. He propels himself into every opportunity he has. And the most opportunity he has, he thinks, is war.
Well, it was amazing. I mean, he is just incredibly self-confident, and his ambition just seems limitless. Where did that come from? Was that something with his family, his parents?
Well, so he was born into a famous family. He's a direct descendant of the first Duke of Marlborough, John Churchill, who's considered to be one of the greatest generals in British history, and he ends up later on writing a biography of him. His father was Chancellor of the Exchequer, which is sort of like being vice president, and he was leader of the House of Commons. And he had died a very early, tragic death. He had only been 45 years old. And Churchill believed that he was going to do great things with his life. But he believed that he, too, would die young. And so he felt like he had to not only make his mark, but make it now.
And his mother helped him a little bit along the way. Tell us a little bit about Jenny, because she's an interesting figure.
She is a piece of work. So Jenny Churchill, his American mother, she was incredibly beautiful and intelligent and charismatic and was admired by many powerful men in powerful positions. And so her son, understood that and made use of it. You know, he said to her, this is a pushing age. We must push with the best. And so every time there was a war somewhere, and this is the height of the British Empire, so there are wars everywhere, and he wanted to go to the hottest spot on the planet. And so he would say to her, I want a military appointment here. Help me make it happen. And she would, time and again, get him where he wanted to go.
He was so desperate to be noticed. You tell a story in your book, and I think it's when he's in India, and he gets on this horse. Everyone else is ducking for cover, and he's just, you know, riding this pony in front of everybody, almost as though he feels invulnerable somehow.
Right, right. A white pony, no less. You know, he was very proud of that. You know, he wanted not only he was very interested in war. He had 1,500 toy soldiers when he was a child. He went to Sandhurst, the military academy. He loved the war games they played there. So he's very interested in it from a young age. But he called it the glittering gateway to distinction. So he wanted not just to fight, to be brave, to be gallant, but he wanted to be noticed fighting and being gallant. And so he could win medals. And he thought, that's the way that I'll get where I need to go. You know, fame, recognition, and eventually political power.
And the Boer War is kind of brewing. Mm-hmm. It hasn't really started. He really beats the drums mm-hmm. for war. Mm-hmm. Was that about him just trying to be noticed, his own glory, or was that there a legitimate case to be made to
yeah,
to go to
there
war?
I mean, I think he thought so. You know, let's be honest, he was an unabashed imperialist. And he believed that everybody basically would be better off being British. And he was very proud of the British Empire and wanted to support it. And South Africa was something that interested England for a long time. You know, Great Britain had to sort of get around the Cape in order to get to India. And but then in the mid-1800s, they found gold and then diamonds in the Transvaal, which was one of the Boer republics. And so obviously that caught their attention even more.
So they do declare war against the Boers, but he doesn't get to go as a military officer. He goes as a war correspondent.
That's right. As I mentioned, so he's 24 years old. He's already written 3 books. He's also worked as a journalist for many years already. So he went to Cuba during the first stirrings of the Spanish-American War, and he had covered that as a journalist. He had gone to British India both as a combatant and as a journalist. He had gone to the Sudan as a combatant and as a journalist. So he had done both, and he was very well known for being an excellent, excellent correspondent. He not only would get to the front wherever the action was faster than everybody else, he was incredibly intrepid and brave. His analysis was brilliant, but his prose was incredibly beautiful, and he was known for that. And so there was a bidding war for him, and he ends up going to South Africa as the highest paid correspondent England had ever had.
Wow. So did the British think this would be an easy war to win?
They did. They thought this was going to be another colonial war. So it starts in October, they think, for sure. It'll be over with in December. They have very low regard for the Boers. The Boers have been living in South Africa for centuries. They're largely Dutch, Huguenot, and German immigrants. And they've been trying for decades to get away from the British Empire. They had what they called the Great Trek, where they moved from the Cape hundreds of miles into the interior, establishing their own republics. And they were incredibly racist. Part of the reason for the Great Trek was because the British Empire had abolished slavery. And so some for good reasons and some not so good, the British Empire had very low regard for the Boers. They thought they're uncivilized. They thought they were bumpkins. But they were wrong to dismiss them militarily because the Boers were very sophisticated fighters. They knew the South African veldt inside and out. They actually had, in some cases, better weapons than the British, which the British were not used to when fighting a colonial war. And they could just disappear without a trace. It was going to be a very different kind of warfare than the British Empire was used to.
Well, it is very interesting in your book. I mean, it's clear there's the British sort of old-fashioned way of warfare, and And then this very modern way of warfare, guerrilla warfare in a lot of ways, that the Boers wage.
Right. It was very surprising for the British Empire. So they called this the Khaki War because it was actually one of the first times that they didn't wear their dashing red coats. And they hated their khaki uniforms. They said they made them look like bus drivers. But they still fought in these perfect, precise lines, sort of served up for the slaughter to the Boers. And the Boers were also using smokeless gunpowder, and they didn't even have any uniforms. They just wore the same kind of dusty brown and gray clothes that they wore every day of their lives. They didn't have a standing army. They certainly didn't have a navy. They weren't an empire, but they would just disappear. And the British were just slaughtered again and again. And so by the time Churchill gets to South Africa, which is just a couple of weeks after the war began, the British Empire are already losing the first battles of the war. They're humiliated, and they're scrambling to adjust to this new, very different, to them, very strange kind of warfare.
Well, let's get back to Churchill, because he ends up close to this front with the British military in a town called Escort, right?
That's
and
right.
They're surrounded by the Boer.
Right.
And there's a plan to, or an order, to take an armored train out to scout the area.
That's right. So the front is at that time Ladysmith, which is south of Pretoria. The Boers have it under siege. It's completely locked down. Churchill wants to get in. He can't. It's completely shut down. So the closest he can get, as you say, is Escort, which is about 40 miles south. And they don't really have a real way for reconnaissance to get out and to kind of see where the enemy is. The only thing they have is this armored train, which it seems in theory like a good idea, but in actuality, it's just a disaster. You know, the British Empire had already lost two armored trains to the Boers because it's just an easy target. You know, here they come along these tracks.
Right. It seems like
that. The Boers just have to wait for them, right? And so everybody understands what a disaster this is. But one day, a friend of his, Ulmer Haldon, who's an old military friend of his, is ordered to take the train out for reconnaissance. And Haldon doesn't have a choice. He has to go. Churchill has a choice. He's just a correspondent. But he's frustrated. He's restless. He later admits that he was eager for trouble. So when Haldon invites him to come along, he doesn't hesitate for a moment to go.
And it does end up being a disastrous mission.
It's a disaster because, of course, the Boers are watching and waiting, and they know not only where the train is going, they know it has to come back on the same tracks. So they wait for the train to go by. They go to the bottom of a hill. They pile rocks on the tracks. Then they go to the top of the hill. As soon as the train comes up, they open fire on it, and it does exactly what they want it to do, is go as fast as it can down the hill to get away from them. It crashes into the rocks at the bottom. The first two cars are catapulted off the tracks. Several men are killed. Many are horribly wounded. The man standing next to Churchill has his arm blown off. So they're in this hailstorm of shells and bullets. And Winston Churchill, 24 years old, one of the few civilians on the train, immediately takes charge of the defense of the train. And what's even crazier is everybody listens to him. Even Ulmer Haldon, his friend, who is actually in charge of all these, you know, legitimate uniformed soldiers on the train, he says, absolutely, what should we do? And they all listen to Churchill.
And they get the train going sort of slowly a little bit. But in the end, he ends up being captured by the Boer forces.
That's right. So they are finally able to push the cars off the tracks that have fallen. So they're able to pile as many as they could of the wounded on the engine and some of the cars in the back and get it going, and it escaped. And interestingly, if you read any of the newspaper accounts, every man who made it out alive credits Winston Churchill, his resourcefulness, his bravery, for saving their lives. But Churchill had jumped off the engine and gone back. He thought there were more men back there who needed his help. And most of them had already been taken as prisoner, and Churchill himself was as well.
We'll return to the interview with author Candace Millard after a very short break. She's talking with Radio Times producer Debbie Builder about her new book, Hero of the Empire. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoane, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. From time to time, we feature producer interviews on the show. So let's get back to Debbie Builder's interview with Candace Millard on her book, Hero of the Empire, The Boer War, A Daring Escape, and the Making of Winston Churchill. When we left off, it was a cliffhanger. The young Winston Churchill had just been captured by the Boer after being ambushed on an armored train. He was sent to an officer's POW camp in Pretoria, where a very depressed Churchill began thinking about how to plot his escape.
So what is the plan that they come up with, the escape plan?
So first of all, Winston Churchill, of course, being Winston Churchill, his plan is not some simple little thing. It's this just ridiculously audacious plan. So he thinks that they're going to take over the officer's prison, and then they'll take over the soldier's prison, and they're going to take over Pretoria, and then they're going to capture the president, and they're going to win the war.
The grandest idea.
Yes, of course. And so he's just this kid, and he's going around telling everyone his plan, and they're kind of like, you know, get out of my way, kid. But he overhears his friend Almer Halton, the man who had invited him on the train, and this other man discussing this very different kind of plan. And the other guy's name is Adam Brockie, and he was a really interesting guy. He had been in South Africa for a while. He knew the land very well. He spoke Afrikaans. He spoke Zulu. And so he was just a really smart, scrappy guy. And Brockie and Halton had this plan. They noticed that, so they have these new electric lights. They're a very new thing in the prison yard. And they noticed that at night when the lights come on, there's a corner of the yard that remains dark. And it's patrolled by armed guards at all times. But they see that sometimes if a guard gets distracted talking to another guard, if he turns his back at the right moment, they can get over this 6.5-foot tall paling that surrounds the yard. And so that's her plan. And so Churchill overhears it and he says, hey, I want in on it. And both men make it clear to him that they don't want to have anything to do. They don't want to bring him, you know, because he's too famous. So he'll be noticed right away if he's gone. He will tell everybody, you know, he talks too much. He's going to tell everybody their plan. And they don't think he's in good enough shape. You know, he's been so depressed at being a prisoner. He's done nothing. Everybody else is playing games and exercising. And he's been sort of sitting around, maybe reading a book a little bit and pouting. And so they say, no, we're not taking you. But he insists. And Halden finally feels bad because he feels like, this is my friend. It's kind of my fault he's here because I invited him on the train. So he says to Churchill, look, so you know, we don't want you to come with us, but I'll leave it up to you. You can make the decision. And Churchill says, I'm coming.
And he seizes the opportunity.
He does. He seizes the opportunity and he gets over the fence and they don't. And they're infuriated and frustrated because he gets over. And when they see their opportunity, they're caught. And they can't. But he's on the other side. And he doesn't really know the plan because they haven't told him much. He doesn't have a map. He doesn't have a compass. He doesn't have food, a weapon, no ability to speak the language, nothing. They have all the provisions on the other side of the fence. But he doesn't have a choice. He has to go on. He waits for them for an hour. He can't go back over. They'll shoot him. So he has no choice but to take his chances.
We've seen this really self-confident Winston Churchill early on. And at this point, there are definitely moments where he's almost paralyzed with indecision. Mm-hmm. He doesn't know what to do. Mm-hmm. That's a very different person than the Winston Churchill who's, you know, helping people in this the train derails and you know, jumping into the fight.
Right. He does. He swings wildly from, you know, incredible confidence that we're used to seeing him to fear and even to desperation. And I think it's very interesting to me to see him alone on the South African veldt with no help and very little hope. And he's not a religious man. But at one point, he finally resorts to prayer, you know, praying for guidance, for some sort of help. And that's when I think we can see him most clearly for the man he was. What interests me when you look at history is not just sort of these big moments of public triumph or infamy, but it's the more private, personal moments of struggle when somebody is sick or scared or desperate. And that's absolutely the case here with Winston Churchill. And you can really see their true character, who they really are at their core.
And the plan is to get to Portuguese-controlled, I guess, Mozambique, essentially, which is hundreds of miles away.
That's right. He has 300 miles of enemy territory that he has to cross by himself. And again, with no provisions, no ability to speak the language, nothing, really just only his own determination, his grit. So all these qualities that we associate with him, you know, and during World War II, all these things, his agility, his ingenuity, and just his determination to not give up, even when he is desperate, even when he thinks that he doesn't have a chance. And remember that the Boers are scouring this area looking for him. They're humiliated. They're enraged. And if they catch him, there's a very real chance that they will kill him. And so he has everything to lose at 24 years old.
And so he gets a train for part of it. He does catch a train. Mm-hmm. And then he ends up, it's really a stroke of good luck when he knocks on it's a door of somebody who turns out to be British.
It's an incredible stroke of luck. So as you might imagine, so there were a lot of Britons living in South Africa at that time because of the gold, because of the diamonds. But when the war started, they forced most of them out, and they only allowed a very few important people to stay, people who would be useful to them. And so Churchill, he's alone. He sees some fires glowing in the distance. And he thinks, first of all, that's an African village. And he thinks, well, the Africans, native Africans, hate the Boers even more than they hate the British, and maybe they'll help me. But as he gets closer, he realizes it's not an African village; it's a colliery, and so he, I mean, you know, chances are he's going to knock on a door, and that person will immediately turn him in. And but as you say, this incredible stroke of luck, he knocks on the one door in many, many miles of a man who's British, who was allowed to stay because he could run this colliery. And so Churchill admits, look, I'm Winston Churchill. I've just escaped from the Boers. Could you help me? And John Howard, this man, just looks at him and turns around and locks the door. And Churchill thinks, this can't be good. this can't be good for me. But instead, the man thrusts his hand out and he says, you know, I'm British. I'll help you. We're going to get you out of here.
And did everyone know? I mean, had news spread that Churchill had escaped, that,
absolutely,
you know, he was on the loose? So even in this corner, they would have heard that.
Absolutely. It was huge, huge news, even in England. You know, Winston Churchill was the son of Lord Randolph Churchill, right, the former Chancellor of the Exchequer. And so it was huge news, and especially because they were losing the war at that point. And they had thought that Buller, the commander-in-chief, would be their hero. They called him the steamroller. They thought he was going to roll over the Boers, but they're losing, and so they don't have a hero. And here's this young son of a lord who's humiliated the Boers, but is where? They don't know where he is. And it's the same thing in South Africa. Absolutely everybody knows. The Boers are everywhere. There are wanted posters put up for Winston Churchill. Everyone's looking. In fact, someone had just come to Howard's door just the day before looking for Winston Churchill.
Where do they end up putting him, hiding him?
So they end up, they have a couple other friends who are English who are also associated with this colliery, and one of them has a store, and he sells wool sometimes to Portuguese East Africa, which, as you said, is now Mozambique. And they decide, okay, we will hide you in one of these wool trucks, and we'll that's how we'll get you to Portuguese East Africa. And that's what they do.
But before that, he has to survive in the coal mine, right?
Albino
rats.
Right. It's just an incredible, incredible story.
While he is on the run and hiding out, the British do have a number of defeats. And there's one particular battle that you write about, the Battle of Colenso, which you really see the distinction between the British military and the Boer military. And it's disastrous. And they send their forces in. They don't know where the Boers are.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about how that
So that's the last battle of what they called Black Week. So Black Week is what they had right at the time when Winston Churchill was escaping. It was one huge battle after another, and culminated with Colenso, where Sir Redvers Buller, he's just blindsided. You know, they're fighting in these perfect, precise lines. The Boers can see them very easily. They can attack them very easily. And, you know, they end up cornering them and just slaughtering them. And Frederick Roberts ends up having to come in and replace Buller. They finally bring Buller home after this battle. And his son, his beloved son, is actually killed in this battle as well. So you can absolutely see the difference. And this is hugely important to the British Empire because they slowly, after this battle, they slowly begin to change their own tactics. So they realize they have to understand guerrilla fighting, you know, in order to win this war. And the British army that goes into this war is completely different from the British army that comes out, and it prepares them for World War One. You know, these are stunning defeats to them, but it absolutely changes them.
I was interested to read that on the battlefield and at Colenso is Gandhi.
Right.
Turns
that's
out.
Right.
Well, we know
right.
as Mahatma Gandhi, but then was
right.
not.
I think people often forget. So that's where he developed in South Africa. He lived there for, I think, 17 years. That's where he developed his ideas for nonviolent resistance. You know, he realized he's this incredibly natural leader and he can bring people together. But at that point, what he was fighting for were rights for Indians under British rule. And so he said, look, we will help you in this war. We'll help you defeat the Boers, but we're not going to fight. But so he put together a group of stretcher bearers, and he ends up later on when after Churchill escapes and he goes back in and begins to fight as a soldier, he's on the same battlefield as Gandhi. Gandhi's a stretcher bearer, and Winston Churchill's fighting in Spion Kop.
So as you said, Churchill does manage to escape. What's the reaction back home in Britain to that?
He becomes a huge, huge hero. He becomes what he had always wanted to be, which is hero of the empire. And everyone is thrilled. It's in all the newspapers. And in fact, the story, it's always the headline about, you know, young Winston Churchill's bravery and, you know, his humiliation of the Boers. And he uses that to his benefit. You know, he's no fool. He very quickly, after he goes back and fights, and he quickly returns home to England while the war is still going on. And he runs for that same seat in Parliament. And this time he wins. And he understands the importance that his role in the South African War played in this. In fact, he writes to the Prime Minister at the time, he says, I owe my victory to my popularity coming out of the war in South Africa.
I'm talking to Candace Millard. She's the author of The River of Doubt and Destiny of the Republic. We're talking about her new book, Hero of the Empire, The Boer War, A Daring Escape, and The Making of Winston Churchill. So what happens in the Boer War? Because it drags on a lot longer than the British had imagined
right.
it would.
That's right. So they think it's going to be a couple of months, and it ends up lasting almost 3 years. And Roberts leaves, and they get yet another. So their third commander-in-chief, which is Kitchener, who, you know, as we all know, goes on having a long and contentious relationship with Churchill. But Kitchener realizes, look, we've got to end this. And they resort to incredible brutality. They use scorched earth tactics, the farm burning. And worse than that, they develop the first concentration camps. So they realize that the Boers are surviving because they have the support system. They have their wives and mothers who are on these farms, and they can quickly go and get food and medical care and shelter at these farms. And so what the British do is they round up all the women and children, they burn the farms, and they put them in concentration camps. Now, of course, they didn't intend to kill them. It's not a Nazi-style concentration camp, but it's almost worse because they kill them by neglect. I mean, the horrific conditions in these camps. They don't have enough food. There's no medical care. The hygiene situation is appalling. And it's just an absolute disaster. And more people die in the concentration camps than die on the battlefields. And then also there are separate concentration camps for Native Africans. When the war started, both sides agreed we're not going to pull Native Africans into the battle. But of course they do, making them work not only as messengers, but also making them fight. And there are separate concentration camps for Native Africans, and more of them die even than the Boers. And finally, a woman from England comes and she sees these horrible conditions and starts to complain about it. And they're finally ended. But by that time, they've broken the Boers and the war ends.
This war also marked, I don't know if you would say the end of the British Empire, but a true sort of change from absolute world domination. Mm-hmm. I think you write in your book that they ruled over one quarter of the human race.
Yes. And so they were constantly putting out revolts, you know, from Egypt to Ireland. But again, believed that everybody would be better off British. You know, they felt that they were this benevolent force in the world. And that absolutely starts to crack. And you see real changes after the Boer War. It does begin to crumble.
And does Churchill realize that? Does he recognize that coming
out? He does recognize that a little bit later, you know, he believed in the British Empire and he was proud of it and he was proud of what he believed it was doing in the world. But he understands that this is a dying age. You know, he was born into, you know, Downton Abbey, basically. So he was born into the, you know, highest ranks of the British aristocracy, the height of the British Empire and Queen Victoria's reign. And Queen Victoria dies in 1900, you know, right on the cusp of a new century at the end of this war. So everything is changing and he absolutely sees it.
So as we said at the beginning, he's, you know, full of self-confidence and ambition. He has, during this period of his life, a number of humbling, frightening experiences. Do you think that shaped how he was as what we think of him as this wartime, you know, this great wartime leader later on?
I do. I think, you know, when we think of Winston Churchill, we think of an old man sending young men into war. But the truth is that nobody understood the reality of war, sort of the tremendous cost and personal tragedy of war more than he did. And he said, even at the time, even before the Boer War, he wrote to his mother, he said, you know, you cannot gild it. The raw comes through. You know, he had nearly been killed many times himself. He had killed men himself. He had watched his friends not just killed, but mutilated, you know, sliced to ribbons by their enemies. So he absolutely understood the cost of it and the reality of it. And he would throughout his life.
Candace Millard, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. Enjoy the conversation. Thank you.
Candace Millard is the author of The River of Doubt and Destiny of the Republic. Her new book is Hero of the Empire, The Boer War, A Daring Escape, and the Making of Winston Churchill.
That was Radio Times producer Debbie Builder, and we feature producer interviews from time to time on Radio Times. Candace Millard's best-selling histories also include The River of Doubt about Teddy Roosevelt's harrowing trip on the Amazon and Destiny of the Republic about the assassination of James Garfield. Coming up next, we'll talk about President-elect Donald Trump's selection of Ben Carson as Secretary of the Department of Housing and Urban Development. We'll talk about what this nomination might mean for urban communities with the reinvestment fund's Ira Goldstein. Stay tuned. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Donald Trump chose his former presidential rival, Ben Carson, to head up HUD, the Department of Housing and Urban Development. Carson is an acclaimed retired neurosurgeon with no government experience and no experience running a large bureaucracy. But he does have opinions and ideas about government programs aimed at the poor. We asked Ira Goldstein to join us to tell us about managing HUD with its 8,300 employees and $49 billion budget. He worked at HUD under the first Bush and Clinton administrations. He's currently the president of Policy Solutions, leading some research on economic development issues for the reinvestment fund. And that's a community development financial institution specializing in the financing of neighborhood revitalization. And Ira, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
What is the overall responsibility for HUD, this department?
HUD has a number of overall responsibilities. First, and probably among the most important, is its original purpose, which was the Federal Housing Administration, which is the insurance of mortgages, most of which are mortgages that are being made these days in middle-class neighborhoods around the country. The second big piece is its public housing mission, and therein it finances housing authorities around the country to provide housing to low-income people, as well as distributes choice vouchers, formerly known as Section 8 certificates. And with that, they're housing, you know, the nation's sort of more lower-income people. In addition, you also have its community planning and development portion, which finances housing and community development activities around the country. Those are block granted dollars that go directly out to cities and states for their other communities around the state to be able to finance things like infrastructure and community assets and things of that nature. And then last but not least, you have the fair housing portion.
Sure.
So HUD's responsible for enforcing the nation's fair housing laws.
And I want to pick up on several of those. And, of course, there have been a number of heads of HUD, the Housing and Urban Development Department. But what kind of skills, what kind of background do you think someone needs to manage this large and sprawling bureaucracy? There are, as I understand it, offices scattered across the country.
Oh, right. There's at least there are 10 regional offices, and then there are state offices around the country, each with sort of a different set of things that they do. And there is a national office, a headquarters in Washington, D.C. So if you were to look back at the prior secretaries, the current Julian Castro, Sean Donovan, Alfonso Jackson, Mel Martinez, folks like that, they have experience in things related to housing typically. Many of them were elected officials before. Some ran housing authorities. Andrew Cuomo, for example, actually was an assistant secretary in HUD before becoming a secretary, ran a homeless agency, which is a huge portion of what HUD is focused on. Henry Cisneros, a mayor of San Antonio. Jack Kemp in the business world and an elected official. So folks tend to have, firstly, an experience in that public sector. Secondly, you'll find that some of the secretaries will have a particular set of experiences in and around financing, so investment banking and the like, very critical to the insurance of mortgage rolls. Others would have experience in a subject matter of HUD, like, as I said, Andrew Cuomo with homelessness, or Sean Donovan ran Housing and Preservation and Development in New York, which is an agency almost as big as HUD when you think about it. So they have that subject matter area. And they also need, I think, that kind of ability to be able to manage the expectations of the executive branch, which is that piece of government within which they work, and the legislative branch, which gives them the laws that they operate under, and HUD has dozens of laws that it enforces, as well as the budget that Congress gives HUD to enforce those laws and to implement its programs.
Seems like a lot of things for a person to do. Obviously, as in any large bureaucracy, you need people around you who can carry out a lot of these rules, roles, recommendations. Is there a kind of built-in bureaucracy at HUD, people that have been there a long time?
Sure. So each one of the pieces of HUD gets its own deputy secretary or assistant secretary, depending on how it's organized. And those people tend to be folks who are brought in from the outside with maybe subject matter expertise in that field. In the fair housing piece, we've always had folks who had experience in either the enforcement of the fair housing laws in public housing or in other different sectors. So you have that, but then you have a whole group of people who are sort of longtime staffers inside of HUD who have that, you know, decades of experience of understanding the laws, understanding the regulations, understanding the intricacies of the housing market and all the different interest groups, the mortgage bankers and the real estate folks who have a great interest in what HUD is. So indeed, there is that sort of human capital infrastructure that exists within HUD.
I think many of us, myself included, remember the high rises that were built, I don't know, was it 60s, 70s? I'm not sure. But these were the public housing that was built that was oftentimes looked like a small skyscraper. Then we see them coming down. Mm-hmm. Was that HUD?
Yes, it was HUD. And that was really the brainchild of a former HUD secretary, Henry Cisneros, who had recognized that that form of public housing was a public policy failure. It had been acknowledged for some time, but nobody was ever able to quite do it, you know, to really sort of address it. So Henry Cisneros and the folks around him created what, you know, I'm sure folks see the results of it in places like Philly, that Hope 6 program, wherein it was the demolition of those high-rise towers, the recreation of neighborhoods with low-rise, mixed tenure owners and renters, some mixed-income folks. And those places became not only better places to live, but better places for the neighborhoods around them. So if you were to think about Richard Allen Homes in Philadelphia, that was a Hope Six site.
Absolutely.
The MLK Hope Six site. You know, so these are places that were really sort of – they were monuments to, I think, public policy failure. And there was plenty of pain and suffering that existed within those places. And then they're demolished. And all of a sudden you get neighborhoods and they're vital places now. This really was – an ability to, you know, if you think about how it comes about, that's an ability of a skilled, savvy political person like a Henry Cisneros to figure out how to navigate, you know, again, the waters around how do you get the money to do this? How do you change the regulations to make it happen? How do you negotiate the amount of replacement that'll take place? So that's sort of just skilled politics. And successful secretaries, I think, need to be able to have that.
And I guess skilled politics when it comes to Congress in Washington, D.C., but then skilled politics on the more local level where some of these changes are actually going to take place.
Absolutely.
Or took place.
Absolutely.
Is the goal of HUD to also reduce poverty or poverty related to housing? Is that part of HUD's goal or mission?
Yeah, I think certainly derivatively, if not like right on point. So if you think about what the FHA mortgages do, those are made mostly to middle-income people. And I would point out that when the country's mortgage markets were tanking and when the country's housing markets were going through the upheaval of the most recent recession, FHA was the vehicle that came in and made sure that there were mortgages flowing in. So during the subprime era, FHA was maybe 2, 3, 5, 6% of the mortgage market. At the peak of the recession, FHA became in some places 40, 50, 60% of the market. And today, if you were to go in cities like Philadelphia or Baltimore or St. Louis, what you'd find is in those 80 to 120% middle income areas that they're anywhere between 40, 60, 70% of the mortgage market. And it's not that they're not making the loans, but they're insuring the loans so that the private mortgage world can make those loans without the risk of loss.
So can we say that HUD helped to at least stabilize some of the fallout from the financial implosion on Wall Street?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And in that, preserve value not only for the people who got the mortgages, but for the people who live in the neighborhoods where those homes are now able to transact in a reasonable, orderly way.
Tell us about the 1968 Fair Housing Act and how HUD implements that.
So HUD implements the Fair Housing Act of 1968 basically said that you can't discriminate on the basis of race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. In 1988, it was amended to include handicap, which is the language of the law, not the artful term of the day, and familial status, which means the presence of children. HUD has responsibility to enforce that law, and they do it in a variety of different ways. One is that they directly take in complaints from the public who feels that either in public or private housing, they've been treated unfairly in a rental housing opportunity, in a for sale housing opportunity, in financing and insuring, or even in tenancy. You know, things like we're paying attention now to the wonderful book by Matthew Desmond on evictions. We're paying attention now to the eviction problem. When I was the director of Fair Housing for the Mid-Atlantic years ago, we used to get with some frequency cases where people weren't being evicted, particularly women, constructively evicted.
What does that mean?
Which means that their landlords were sexually harassing them and they could no longer live there feeling safe and, you know, and like. So HUD has to enforce all of the, you know, that Fair Housing Act and through its the processing of complaints. HUD in 1988 got the authority to initiate complaints on its own motion, which on the secretary's motion, which means the secretary takes notice of a practice that's problematic, and without somebody coming forward, they are able to try and remedy a situation. Then there are also other aspects of fair housing that get enforced through that law. So states and local agencies that have laws that are roughly equivalent, or the term of art is substantially equivalent to the federal fair housing law, they can take in those complaints and HUD pays them to process those complaints. And then there are all sorts of other related laws that sort of get at, you know, particular aspects of public accommodations or, you know, federal contracting and the like. One other piece I think is really important is from the day that the Fair Housing Act was written, with the intention of Congress to essentially look at the fact that we were becoming two societies, separate and unequal, HUD was given the responsibility by Congress at that time to make sure that HUD programs were administered in a way that would affirmatively further that title, to make sure that those dollars that, you know, came into cities and the like really were spent, invested, deployed in a way to make sure that we undo the vestiges of discrimination and segregation.
I think it should be said that Donald Trump and his father were charged with housing discrimination under the Fair Housing Act. They did. There was a consent decree. I think they did not plead guilty, but nonetheless, it was used against them for their practices of not renting to African Americans.
Sure, and that was at a time, by the way, before HUD had as much authority as it had. In 1988, Congress saw fit to rest real law enforcement authority inside of HUD, so the ability to write subpoenas, to send people to federal court, and all those other things didn't really exist in the early versions of the law, and so had that circumstance occurred post 1988, it might have gone a different way. I don't know the facts of that situation, but the enforcement authorities were very different post 1988.
Well, we're talking about what HUD does, and it is a large, although not the largest, department in the U.S. government, something like $49 billion budget, more than 8,000 employees. And we asked Ira Goldstein to join us and explain how it works and some of the laws that drive HUD's decisions. And he's the president of Policy Solutions. And if you have any questions or comments, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. I was reading about a controversial program. It has a weird title. It's not exactly a title, but it's called Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing. And it's come under criticism. Its future may be uncertain at this point. But what is this about?
So the generalized concept of that is that, again, in 1968, when Congress wrote the law that established the Fair Housing Act, what they said was, HUD has a responsibility to ensure that its programs are administered in a way that further the title, which means to make sure that, you know, they're non-discriminatory and that you're acting in a pro-integrative way, which was the sort of the theory of the Fair Housing Act. For many years, HUD's activities under the assessment of fair housing or the were really more administrative than proactive. And I think that, you know, in the last, 8 or 10 years, there has been a concerted effort on the part of HUD. And I would say even in the case of some municipalities and the like, and certainly in the advocacy community, to make sure that HUD was more aggressive in terms of its enforcement of that provision of the Federal Fair Housing Act. So a couple of years ago, the regulations around that were rewritten. They were made more complex. They were made more far-reaching. But the generalized idea was that places that received community development block granting funds, CDBG, were supposed to take a good hard look at what's going on in their community and try and really understand what the state of segregation is, what the forces behind it are, who's most adversely impacted by it, to understand whether or not community had true voice in the way their dollars were being spent, et cetera. And then to take what were known as significant actions with their federal funds to make sure that those things were addressed.
Mm. And the idea is to deal with the problem of segregation in housing. We are almost out of time here. How much, though, does the Secretary of HUD have? How much latitude and flexibility do they have in carrying out various policies? If they have their own policies, do they have to go through Congress in order to get that approved? In about 27 seconds.
In 27 seconds, the short order is the laws are the laws, but they do get interpreted administratively within the agency. And from secretary to secretary, you'll see different things emphasized. And you'll also see that there's input from the president and there's also input from Congress. But they do have latitude, and it's mostly on the interpretation and on the funding side.
Well, the short version, thank you very much, Ira Goldstein, for joining us today on Radio Times, President of Policy Solutions, giving us a snapshot of HUD, the Department of Housing and Urban Development. And the reason for the show, we wanted to get an understanding of this department because Donald Trump chose Ben Carson to head it up. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, Elizabeth Fiedler, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thanks for joining us.